or the universities are an absolute wreck, okay? You know, right now. They're pygmies. I'm telling you, they are passive worms. You, as a man, you cannot possibly know what I'm talking about because you can talk.
In a time when more and more students on college campuses are demanding political correctness from those around them, how have faculty responded? Reason TV's editor-in-chief Nick Gillespie sat down with college professor, author, and social critic Camille Paglia at Reason Weekend to talk about that, as well as feminism, Prince's career, Beyoncé's Lemonade album, and more.
Let's get started here. Part of what we're talking about this weekend at Reason is kind of the state of the university, and you know, what is the university over as a meaningful place, as a site of new cultural production and knowledge? And we're going to be talking, you know, about students and the way students are controlled. But can you talk a little bit, how do you feel about the state of the university from the professor's point of view? Are professors, particularly in the arts and the humanities and the social sciences, are they bringing what they should be bringing to research universities?
The universities are an absolute wreck, okay? You know, right now, because for decades, okay, any graduate student in the humanities who had independent thinking, it was driven out. Okay, there was no way to survive without memorizing all of these stupid bromides with this reverential bowing to these overinflated figures like Lacan, Derrida, Foucault, and so on. And basically, it's been a tyranny in the humanities because the professors who are now of my age, who are the baby boom professors, who made their careers on the back of Foucault and so on, are determined, okay, that survive. And so you have a kind of vampirism going on. But I've been getting letters. I've been getting letters for, you know, since, for 25 years since Sexual Personae was released in 1990 from refugees from the graduate schools. Okay, so it's been a terrible loss. One of my favorite letters was early on. A woman wrote to me who she was painting houses in St. Louis, and she said that she had wanted a career as a literature professor and had gone into the graduate program in comparative literature at Berkeley. And finally, she was forced to drop out because she said every time she would express enthusiasm for a work they were studying in the seminar, everyone would look at her as if she had in some way created a terrible error of taste. I thought, oh my God, okay. That's what's been going on, is that a certain sort of a pretentious style of superiority to the text, and every text, of course, is supposed to be dissolving itself. Okay? So it's all self-reflexive. At the end, nothing means anything, and the professors believe that they have some, that this is an accomplishment to reduce great works of art to nothing. Let me just say. So the graduate training has been systematically removing from the grad students the one thing you need as a teacher in the undergraduate classroom: enthusiasm, passion, conviction. Okay? An independent point of view.
So one of the things she mentioned, letters, I highly recommend, if you don't, read her, I guess it's weekly column at Salon, where Camille's been an advice columnist for 20 years or so.
It began
and
a spy magazine.
Along with, I think, Andrew W.K., who is a musician and motivational speaker in the Village Voice, these are the two great advice columnists, like Forget Ann Landers, Forget Dear Abby, and the range of topics that you cover, and it's really a fantastic thing.
When Spy magazine announced my debut in Agony Aunt column, Ask Camille, it was on the same cover that they had the great Hillary Clinton dominatrix cover. Okay, so I mean it's been fantastic. There's Hillary Clinton in the White House, in the Oval Office desk, in a dominatrix outfit, and then there's a band and Camille Paglia debut Agony Aunt. Ask.
So what needs to change?
We've been joined to the hip.
Or what can change in the university to bring that back in?
Because rebellion by the grad students. This is what I'm trying to foment. Mm-hmm. Okay, we absolutely need someone to stand up, okay, and start criticizing authority figures. But no, okay, this generation of young people have been trained throughout middle school and high school and college, okay, to be subservient to authority. There is no question of authority or whatever. They want an expansion of authority. Everything of my generation stood against. Okay? We drove, you know, the administrators out of our private lives, out of the in loco parentis mode. And now today's kids have been raised in a helicopter parent, you know, fashion. They feel warm and cozy. Okay, by additional expansion, of authority of these Budinsky, okay, you know, people, I mean, it's mediocrity, so who, like the bureaucrats who infest university. University life has become increasingly unpalatable because of this, you know, thanks to federal regulations, you know, forcing the adding on and adding on and adding on of more layers of bureaucracy. It's a nightmare, an outrage, and none of the faculty have fought back. Now, they pretend to be leftists, okay? No, they're pygmies. Okay, I'm telling you, they are passive worms, okay? Not to fight back against the bureaucrats.
So talk a bit about, you know, in the 60s, I mean, there's that great moment in Berkeley with the free speech movement, which started when students, and I guess it was a grad student, stood up and protested at Berkeley in the 60s, unless you were an official member of the Democratic or Republican students groups, you couldn't leaflet. And that's what the free speech movement was actually about just handing out all sorts of literature. Where do you see, I mean, is there going to be that, who is going to be, you know, the university's tank man in Tiananmen Square carrying his shopping bags and standing up?
Well, I mean, there has to be a rollback. The faculty has been absolutely servient, okay, to this mad overgrowth of authority. I mean, I wrote a piece in 1992 called The Nursery School Campus that was very prophetic. Okay, it was in the Times Literary Supplement in England. And they queried me when the article was in press, and they said, what is this dean of students thing that you refer to? I said, you don't have a dean of students? They said, no. I said, what do you have? It turns out, okay, at Oxford and Cambridge, okay, there was practically no administrative bureaucracy of any kind. He said, oh, we do have the man who runs the cafeteria, okay, et cetera. So the provosts and the heads of everything are like drawn from the faculty, and then when they're done with that position, they go back to the faculty. So what's happened, which is extremely, you know, pernicious and toxic in American universities over the last 35 to 40 years, okay, is this growth of a massive administrator class who had never had any teaching experience whatever, and regard themselves as a master race, and I am not kidding, okay, all right, and they force you into every kind, there's all kinds of formulas you have to follow, you know, to deal with the students, and every kind of regulation and law, okay, and they're a bunch of nervous Nellies, et cetera, okay, it's an outrage, and there is no, the faculty has been reduced, okay, to slave status, they're serfs, and from coast to coast here, it's an absolute outrage. And again, you know, all these people pretending, like Judith Butler, these people pretending to be leftists, okay, and then in being paid, you know, $500,000, okay, with the yearly salaries, and having with their you know, armies of editorial assistants and people running. The corruption has been untouched by the major media. Why? Because all these graduates of the elite schools go and get jobs at the New York Times. Okay, that's why.
Talk, so there's definitely that bureaucratic encroachment on all sorts of university life.
Tremendous.
Talk, you know, you mentioned Foucault, Derrida, Lacan, and it's interesting, Jacques Lacan is a French psychoanalyst who actually was the hero of a 1978 Reason cover story called France's New Anti-Statist Philosophy. I did not discover that when I was in grad school. I would have loved, it would have made all the Lacanians at SUNY Buffalo cry themselves to sleep to know that Reason had something good about him. But what is, and these are very different guys with different ideas, but what is the kind of overall message or idea that they were giving that has made, do you think that has led to a conformity of thought among professors?
Well, the number one error of Lacan, Derrida, Foucault, and so on, okay, is that language structures everything. There is no reality. There is, and knowledge is not possible, okay, without language. And I'm thinking, all these decades of crap pouring out of these elite schools based on this stupid idea. I've been teaching in art schools, okay, my entire career. Excuse me, my dancers are totally inarticulate. Okay? That's not how they perceive the world. Okay, they express they process the world through the body.
Maybe they just didn't have the right English teacher.
No, that is not how my ceramicists do not process the world. Anyone who works with their hands is not processing reality through language. Okay, this is all based on an outmoded linguistics of Saussure. Okay, it's absolute nonsense. Okay, right from the start, there are different parts of the brain. These people, they're all scientific illiterates, okay, which is why there's no biology, okay, as a required element in women's studies. Which wouldn't you think, when you're putting together a women's studies program, that the first thing would be that any graduate of that program would need to have one course, maybe, in biology to study endocrinology and hormones? No, okay, and so on. It's all language. It's all language. And that's why gender is nothing but language, you see? Okay, right? We're entering this transgender nightmare, okay? All we hear is transgender, because they honestly believe that gender is not grounded in the body. They have absolutely no scientific knowledge, okay? These people in the humanity.
That leads to my next question. This is a group that leans towards the scientific, I think. A lot of the people work here. Have an engineering background. We heard last night from a congressman who has a BA and an MA from MIT. We heard earlier from somebody from Caltech this morning who put down MIT for not really being a very good school. You just make the case to a room of people who are interested in the humanities but maybe not grounded in why should we study the humanities? What's the value?
My views are quite old-fashioned, okay? Which is that right now, that American universities and colleges are choked with meaningless electives, which fragment knowledge and simply allow a professor to boondoggle and to be using a class and to generate ideas for his or her own research. Okay, now I believe in the great survey courses. I believe in history and structure. Okay? I would like to cut and sweep out 60% of the electives, the cafeteria menu, which is, I think, a plague, and which has produced these graduates who know absolutely nothing. And I'm really not kidding. They know nothing. I encounter these graduates of the elite schools, okay, in the media, and their minds are utterly unformed and wandering. Okay, they know nothing. They know all the current ideology, and that's it. Okay? So what I'm saying, okay, is that, again, what I said before, there are different parts of the brain, and there's one part of the brain that's the dreaming part, that is the imaginative part, that projects meaning into human existence. I believe in meaning. I don't believe in deconstructing or destroying meaning in my undergraduates. Okay, so absolutely evil. These people are evil.
But
okay?
you do.
Wait, I'm still on the roll.
Right. I wanted to go back to hormones.
Saying, okay, yes, in terms of the value, okay, the art, okay, is to me one of the ultimate creations of the human spirit. Okay? But even though I'm an atheist, I ground art in religion. Art began as religion. That is the theme, actually, of Sexual Personae. It begins by showing the worldview of the Stone Age. I mean, so I believe that art has the ability to condense, okay, the whole of human life, you know, to unite all the races, all the cultures, all the societies. Okay? So these moments of a flash of insight, okay, that can give you the meaning of human life. That's what humanity's teaching should be about, but has ceased to be, okay, as the professor thinks that it is his or her obligation to transport an external ideology, okay, into the classroom. Okay? I'm completely opposed to this use of the classroom for advocacy. Okay? There are many, many scandals going on in American academia that are completely unaddressed, okay, by the major media.
What are the what is the course that every science major, every economics major, every women's studies major, every English major should take? Is there
I would have wanted is now being destroyed everywhere, okay, except where there is a rebellion, you know, by graduates, by alumni, and that is the great art history survey course, okay, which these graduate students are incapable of teaching because they believe it's all about a false narrative of history. Okay, those courses that began a two-semester course, it began in Stone Age in art and goes all the way down to modernism and Jackson Pollock and so on. Okay, it gives you the sweep and the variety. It's exactly for the non-major. Okay, and those courses, you know, are disappearing, and they are and it's almost impossible to imagine bringing them back because the graduate students have such small minds now, okay, and haven't been trained in terms of the big idea. I believe in big ideas.
What is the art form, contemporary art form that excites you?
Music. I mean, I teach an art of song lyric course, and what I do in that course is to present history and chronology and tradition, okay, to the students and to create order out of this tremendous like swirl of music that they're inundated with. They have, you know, everything is available to them, okay, but they have no sense whatever of history, none. In any field, I'm saying, okay, they're educated. Their public school education is completely atrocious, okay, and it's a failure to present a history as like a huge thing that relates to us now.
And to be clear, I mean, you want to argue about that history, right? You're not preaching that there is some kind of received history that we should be following as much as there's a timeline and then let's fight over.
No, not at all. No, I believe in the arts. There's Mm-hmm. I believe that you can detect influence, okay, and through the generation. And so, you know, like just my last class yesterday, you know, in the Art of Song Lyric, okay, I'm demonstrating how James Brown, you know, gave birth to funk, okay, which gave birth to this, gave birth to that, and here is that you can see this, you know, this right. cascading of influence. That is a great obsession of mine to demonstrate the cohesiveness of art history in all its genres.
Talk about, you know, you mentioned James Brown, you mentioned funk. Prince just died. Mm-hmm. Prince is a fascinating character because he's an androgyne. He was unbelievably sexual. He made gestures constantly to the heavens in his lyrics and in his playing. And yet he was also unbelievably filthy as a performer and as a lyricist. You know, what are your thoughts on Prince now that he's
well,
no longer
Prince
living?
Was the next step from Rick James and funk. Okay, but what Prince added to funk. Funk was all about pure sex, you know, pelvic thrust and giant chords, a kind of overwhelming, almost fascist style. And what Prince did to it was make it very intimate, okay, and actually restore tenderness and love, okay, to it. Okay, they sort of, you're sexy, but I love you like that. So, right. The point, what you mentioned, okay, that conflation of sexuality and spirituality is not that unique to Prince. Right. It is one of the outstanding elements of African-American culture, which I demonstrate in my Art of Song Lyrics course, goes all the way back to West Africa, okay? And so there's the enormity in the power of the gospel tradition, okay, in African-American life, right? And the passion in the soul movement of soul music in the 1960s, where there's a direct transfer of gospel-style singing and themes, okay, into a romantic context. You can see it in Marvin Gaye and then the masterpiece, What's Going On, 1971, and so on. Right, that's a fusion, okay, that I think is ultimately West Africa.
You know, how do your students take this? And the reason I bring this up is when Prince died, my first thoughts almost went to the way that Tipper Gore, who in the mid-80s started a group called the Parents Music Resource Center, which tried first to block certain types of songs from being released or then putting stickers on them. And she and Al Gore engineered a Senate hearing where they kept talking about how the government had no role in this, but, you know, we should be putting stickers on things and we're in the Senate, but we really want to assure you that there's no government involvement, et cetera. But Tipper Gore actually mentions a Prince song, Darling Nikki, which is an absolutely filthy song. That she had bought an album for her daughter, who was then 12 or 13, the Purple Rain soundtrack album, which had been at the top of the charts for like a year almost by the time. But they listened together, and they were embarrassed by the, you know, just the sensuality and the sexualization of the song. That led her to start the PMRC and get this whole kind of thing going. Are your students like that? Or like, you know, especially because you're saying they're helicoptered, they're, you know, kind of clammed up. Our kids grow up in institutional settings. Do they respond to this? Or are they like, come on, mom?
Well, you know, it's interesting because this generation has grown up with a tremendous amount of bared flesh, and very sexy clothing, and sex everywhere, and video games, and so on and so forth. But it's not that they're prudish, but I have to be careful, okay? I feel like, you know, it's not that I do trigger warnings or I worry about microaggression. Like that.
I would tend to think you are your own trigger warning.
I think it's appropriate. I think there's a question of appropriateness, and I just am very aware, okay, that maybe over the last 10, 15 years, that you cannot even they don't find anything about sex funny. Okay, there's no way to make a joke. Right? They in fact, I think sense of humor in general is waning. Okay, they don't have the kind of raucous sense of humor of the, let's say, the ethnic generations of Jews and Italians who emerge, you know, from the kind of working class past. So, I don't, it's odd, okay? Sex everywhere, and yet they seem embarrassed by sex and talking about sex.
You know, one of the things that you started out early on saying that you're a libertarian or that you consider yourself libertarian, and I think you and I share an interest in using it as an adjective rather than as a noun, that we, you know, we have,
yes,
libertarian,
right,
impulses, libertarian interests. You recently, in a very good conversation with Tyler Cowen at George Mason, that's up online that you can find, you said, I'm not saying we need to return to anything. I'm a libertarian. That's why I'm always freely offending both sides. And to give you the chance to offend some people here, perhaps in a way that they haven't been yet. Talk a little bit about, you are a Democrat. Libertarians, to the extent, and we're all small L libertarians here, to the extent that they tend to identify with either the Republican or Democratic Party, it tends to be Republican. You made a good case for the humanities. Make a good case for why small L libertarians should be flooding the Democratic Party.
Well, I mean, I'm alienated from the current party structure. I'd like to, smash the DNC. And I've been supporting Bernie Sanders, the insurgent movement. But I love the kind of Hubert Humphrey era type populist Democrat. I believe there is a role, okay, for government in terms of public welfare and care for the needy and the weak and so on. But I oppose, the bloat of government and intrusion of regulation and so on. I believe that something should be built into governmental structure, including even at the diversity level, okay, to constantly be critiquing bureaucracy as it inevitably swells and reducing it. And bureaucracy, you can see it everywhere in human history. Bureaucracy is the result of a civilization that devised originally a very cohesive and positive sense of order and hierarchy. I mean, that is how irrigation was brought, okay, to the desert, the ancient Babylon and the ancient Assyria and so on, through this hierarchical organization and planning. But every culture over time, as I read history, eventually the bureaucracy swells and swells and swells parasitically, and the whole structure eventually collapses, okay, from it. Because the bureaucrat, by definition, is not an original mind or an original entity. Bureaucrat, okay, is a parasite. Okay. So you can see that Rome fell in this way. Rome got too big, because of it. You can see it's happened in Russia. See it everywhere. Okay. So
do you want to be there when it happens in the U.S., or has it already happened?
What?
Or do you want to be
the collapse
be
of
there
the
when
government?
It collapses? Or the civilization?
Well, I mean, I have been warning. Okay? I've been warning and warning. Okay, for 20 years now.
Yeah.
Okay, that Western civilization is obviously in its decline. It's so obvious because as I analyze history at Indigenous Sexual Personae, when you start to get transgender phenomena, when you start to get a sophisticated toleration of homosexuality, okay, by the urbane, the metropolitan elites, okay, that's a sign that the culture starts to set. Okay?
So, but I
call myself a decadent. I love that period. Okay, I love the transgender period. Okay, but there's absolutely no way you can see. In fact, which book was it? My publisher asked me to lighten up. Okay, they never asked me to do anything except they asked me to lighten up at the end of one of my prefaces in the last 10 years, or whatever, where I was actually saying as Western. They said they found it too depressing. The idea that the culture was on the way down.
Let's for a last comment here, and then we'll open it up to questions. You mentioned Sexual Persona, which showed up in 2013. The LA Times asked David Bowie to list his 100 favorite books or most influential books, and it's a phenomenal list. I mean, it's really, you could spend the rest of your life becoming very smart reading what he thought were important books, including yours.
Yes.
David Bowie also, possibly the greatest instantiation of androgyny and of sexual all sorts of things. He died this year along with, I don't know who's next in the great pantheon of kind of transsexual figures, but what are your thoughts on David Bowie's passing and his influence?
Well, I wrote this piece for the Victorian Albert Museum. Did this giant costume show of David Bowie's stuff from his warehouses, and it's like been a blockbuster. It was like the biggest ticket sales in the history of the V&A, and is still touring the world. And so they apparently Bowie told them to ask me to contribute the essay on gender in Bowie to the catalog. So I think it's one of my most important pieces. It's called A Theater of Gender, David Bowie at the Climax of the Sexual Revolution. I'm demonstrating, which is now completely forgotten, okay, that actually what he was doing by going in the drag direction was contrary, okay, to where the gay movement was going. The 1970s, gay men had moved into the clone look, very macho, okay, and they rejected femininity in the Oscar Wilde kind of heritage of like campiness, elegance, everything that had to do with art. Sort of went out the window. But Bowie, to me, like one of the absolutely major artistic figures of our time, and doing this research that I did over the course of a year, it really demonstrates to me how erudite he was, how sophisticated, how much he knew about the arts. And once, actually, in the early 90s, it was a fiasco. He tried to reach me I got a message through my publisher, David Bowie wants your phone number. And I burst out laughing. I said, that takes the cake. Oh, right, so David Bowie wants my phone number. Okay, so obviously some crazy fan. And so I completely dismissed it. Well, David Bowie did want my phone number. And anyway, he wanted to quote from Sexual Persona in an album that he was doing. Okay, and so I missed that. Okay, so I feel very embarrassed after all, still about that.
Is this the best time to be a woman and to be an individual? We may be in a decline from, I don't know, whenever, but, you know, is there equity, not in terms of gender equity and not in terms of some kind of bureaucratized standard, but do women have more opportunity to shape their own lives now than at any point in history?
Absolutely. They have
and
the
where does that come from?
They have the opportunity from capitalism.
Yeah.
Hello. Okay. You know, when capitalism came along, okay, suddenly, okay, women were emancipated, okay, and were finally had the ability to work outside the home and not to be dependent any longer on father or husband, brother. Okay. So you know, feminism owes capitalism an enormous debt but refuses to acknowledge it. However, okay, yes. Women have tremendous opportunities now to shape their own lives and to support themselves in a huge array of professional careers to move into. But there's a tremendous unhappiness, okay? Tremendous unhappiness, and I think the discussion is almost impossible to carry forward because every time you try to raise biological issues, okay, and so we got people start screaming at you and saying you're trying to push women back and just to be like baby machines, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, anyway, what my analysis is, okay, as someone who's like studies the whole history of mankind, that the human species has for a million years, okay, gone into mating in what today would be teenage year. Okay? Girls were getting married and having children in their late teens. That's even a little bit late. Okay. All of a sudden, we have this technocratic system that's offered tremendous freedom and autonomy to women, okay, to live like men. Okay. But the idea that our hormones, okay, are somehow able to suddenly adjust to this radical shift, it's like stupid. There's like absolutely no study of it. There's absolutely no discussion of it. I see young women very unhappy. I see professional women extremely unhappy. I feel that now there is this forced feeder going on. A young girl is talented. Okay, she's intelligent. Her parents want the best for her, but she's told. Hey, here's the track. You're going to leave high school and you're going to go to college. Okay, and then if you're going to have a professional school, you'll go to professional school and so on. This infinite postponement. Okay, of mating. Okay, and of settling down. If a young girl says, I don't feel like going to college to an upper middle class family in Westchester, New York. Okay, I don't feel like going to college. I feel like getting married. You're wasting your talents, okay? Yeah. You're wasting your talent. You're wasting your life, okay? To follow the promptings of your biology and to marry and to mate and to have children, okay, at an early period. Now, I personally believe that it's healthier for women to have children early, okay? and it's a terrible choice because then I'll be on the you'll be on the mommy track. You'll lose power. You'll lose material advantages in the world. Okay, so we have this thing where I see misery everywhere. I see bitching by women at every level. Okay, of the middle class, the middle class and the upper middle class. Okay, they are extremely unhappy. Okay, and what I see is working class young women. Okay, marrying early, having children early, being grandmothers by the time they're in their 30s and 40s. Right, and where I witness this. It's like on the Jersey Shore. I walk along the shore, and I see all these families, working class families, who are at the motels, and they have like a huge multi generations are on there. I'm going, look at all this. Look at the obvious happiness, okay, of
this,
these working
I
class families with all of their children.
I thought now you're sounding like a nostalgic. This is like watching the movie.
This is what I mean. Okay, immediately the value judgment.
The Irish
judgments immediately. Okay, all right. Not listening. I'm one of the great observers of the sexual.
I grew up on the Jersey Shore. No. Trust in a lower middle class family.
No,
we hated each other.
I'm sorry.
You know?
I'm sorry, Nick.
We're just like the wealthy.
No, I'm sorry, Nick. What I'm talking about is absolutely major. Okay, the misery and unhappiness. Okay, of the professional class, I see it everywhere. I go to Brazil. I go to Norway. I go to England. Okay, and so on. And I hear the same complaints. I see the same unhappiness. The same disjunction. Okay, there's tremendous unhappiness in the heterosexual world. Okay, right? We have not adjusted yet. Okay, to women moving into this cold mechanism, okay, this fabulous and productive mechanism that has allowed women to be you know, to have autonomy and to lead their own lives without dependency, okay? But there are all kinds of biological things that we have no language for, we have no way to measure, okay? And there's a disrespect for it. You see, immediately, okay, you want to squelch it, okay? As a man, you cannot possibly know what I'm talking about because you can talk... You are
that much,
a man.
That much I'll grant you.
You are a man, okay? A star, okay? A superstar man, okay?
Sometimes
nevertheless,
I feel like
a man.
What is your take on Beyoncé and Lemonade, her visual album?
I haven't seen it, okay, yet, but, you know, all I've seen is the publicity about it. But, you know, to me it looks extremely overblown. I find it very vulgar, okay, to be, when you have a child, to be advertising, you know, your... that child's father's infidelities. I think that it's gross, okay, grotesque, in fact. I think she's extremely talented, but I regard her as, over the top. Okay?
What do you mean by over the top?
She's incredibly talented, but her singing style has gotten megalomaniacal, okay, all right, which superstars do, you know, they get into that mode. Barbara Streisand got into it, okay, you know, at a certain point, you know, and, like, floated off the Empyrean. You know, compared to her, the wonderful, you know, skill, you know, and subtlety of Streisand's early phrasing, so on. I just think that, you know, Beyoncé is, you know, I'm a feminist, but I'm also going to, like, carp about my husband's lovers and so on and so forth. I don't know, a lot of hype.
So, you know, it's funny because you know, a lot of people reading your work are like, oh, you know, you're talking, you see pornography everywhere, you see sex and eroticism, and yet you're also extremely moralistic. Don't you think? And I don't say that in a bad way. I'm just as a description.
The point is, I'm a great fan of the early Madonna. Okay, where her exhibition of the body, her use of pornographic tropes was very disciplined and really. And I think because she was working with European directors in her videos and so on. And I think we're into a period now where people have, because we've lost any sense of limit. There's nothing erotic now. Okay? It's not in the least that I'm moralist. I adore a truly erotic pornography, but it's not being made now. Okay, the most erotic period was that moment when the Hollywood studio system was breaking down, and you had Marilyn Monroe. Okay, you know, who was straining at the limits of it, and so on. And you have Elizabeth Taylor and Butterfield 8, which is practically my canonical work. Okay, as a high class call girl in Manhattan.
She couldn't die quick enough. So spoiler alert: she couldn't die quick enough in that movie.
Oh, right, and of course she has to drive off a cliff at the end or to be killed and so on. All right, I think to get true eroticism, there have to be limits. Okay, all right. And when anything goes, there's nothing erotic is left. And that's what we're left with now.